Random House Audio presents Red Storm Rising by Tom Clancy. Read for you by F. Murray Abraham.
They were Muslims. They moved swiftly, silently, with purpose under a crystalline, star-filled night in western Siberia. No one had heard them. An oil refinery is a noisy place, and this was one of the world's largest refining complexes. They approached the brick-walled, windowless building that was central control. Ordinary procedure dictated that to enter the master control room, one first had to be recognized and cleared by the guard, and so it happened. Lisha, you're working tonight. You'll pass.
One of my valves went bad this afternoon. I forgot to check the repair status before I went off duty. If it's still down tomorrow, we'll have to reroute, and you know what that means.
It's true enough. You stand back while I open this damned hatch.
Lisha!
The staff inside could not fail to note the sound of three shots, but none of them was armed.
Isha, what are you... Infidel! All of you!
There was nowhere to run. No way around this swarthy, towering killer and his men. They had planned and memorized every detail of this task over a period of months. Isha rushed to the computer controls to send 80 million liters of gasoline to gush out from a bank of truck-loading valves. He then opened and closed the valves to the main pipeline, rupturing it a dozen places. It took only one spark to spread the Holocaust before the winter wind. By the time the KGB arrived, there was nothing they could do to stop the fire. They could only stop the terrorists.
I take refuge in the Lord of the Worlds, the King of men, the God of men. Allahu Akbar.
Isha and his men were dead. Around them, the whole world seemed to be catching fire, and because of them, the whole world really would. The news of the fire was reported the following day on the AP wire services. A serious oil field fire had been reported in the central region of the Soviet Union by military and intelligence sources in Washington. Sources in the Pentagon confirmed this report, noting that the energy given off by the fire was sufficient to cause a brief stir in the North American Aerospace Defense Command, which was concerned that the fire was a possible missile launch directed at the United States. The sources indicate that numerous fatalities might result from this major fire, but were unwilling to speculate on the cause of the fire. The oil production field accounts for roughly 31.3% of total Soviet crude oil. The fire is the latest in a series of setbacks to the Soviet oil industry. Last fall, Petroleum Industry Minister Zatilin was replaced by Mikhail Sergeyev, former chief of the Leningrad Party apparatus, regarded as a rising star in the Soviet Party. Sergeyev's task of reorganizing the Soviet oil industry following this disaster is seen as a task that could last years. Mikhail Sergeyev never had a chance to read the West's wire service report. He had been summoned to a meeting of the Politburo. He had been a candidate or non-voting member of the Politburo for only 6 months, advising, along with his eight other junior colleagues, the 13 men who alone made the decisions that mattered in the Soviet Union. His portfolio was energy production and distribution. He began his report.
Comrades, at approximately 2300 hours yesterday, Moscow time, three armed men entered the central control complex of the Nizhnevartovsk oil complex and committed a highly sophisticated act of sabotage. We only have identification for one of them, Senior Engineer Isha Tolkazi. He evidently used his expert knowledge of the control systems to initiate a massive fire which spread rapidly before high winds. A security team of 10 KGB border guards responded quickly and well. They killed the traitors within minutes, but were unable to prevent the complete destruction of the facility, both the refining and production fields.
The defense minister was too angry to let Sergeyev continue.
And if the guards responded so fast, how then did they fail to prevent this act? And what was this black-ass Muslim doing there in the first place?
Comrade, work in the Siberian fields is arduous, and we had had serious difficulties in filling the posts we had there. My predecessor decided to conscript experienced oil field workers from the Baku region to Siberia. This was madness. You will recall that my first recommendation last year was to change this policy. Before the border guards were able to kill the traitors sabotaged the oil field control systems. The KGB troops were forced to evacuate the building, which was later consumed by fire. There was nothing more they could have done. Isha Tolkazi had been chosen for special treatment because of his intelligence and supposed loyalty. He was an honor student, educated at Moscow State University, and a member in good standing of the local party. It would also seem that he was a religious fanatic capable of astounding treachery. After 15 years in the party, a good salary, the professional respect of his comrades, even his own automobile, his last words were a shrill cry to Allah. The reliability of people from that region cannot be predicted.
So, tell us, what effect will this fire have on oil production?
Comrades, we have lost 34% of our total crude oil production for a period of at least 1 year, possibly as many as three. And this net total production loss understates the actual impact on our economy. Siberian oil is light, sweet crude. This means that it contains a disproportionately large amount of the most valuable fractions, those which we use to make gasoline, kerosene, and diesel fuel, for example. The net loss in these particular areas are 44% of our gasoline production, 48% of kerosene, and 50% of diesel. These figures are rough calculations, but they should be accurate to within 2%. We can begin to restore production in 12 months. Within a year, that is, 6 months after we commence the redrilling, we will begin to bring the production wells back on stream, and full restoration of the wells will be achieved within 2 more years.
So, even 3 years from now, production may not be completely restored.
Correct, Comrade Minister.
And how long can the country operate on this basis?
Comrades, there is no denying that this is a disaster of unprecedented scale for our economy. The fuels we produce serve us in many ways. We can make perhaps a modest reduction in the use of light oils in electrical power usage, but even now we have a serious shortfall in electric power production, resulting in occasional brownouts and complete power outages. Further cuts in power generation will adversely affect such crucial state activities as factor production and rail transport. As far as conversion to coal production is already below the planned output and getting worse. Conversion to gas is much more attractive, but much of our gas goes to Western Europe. It is from this that we gain Western currency to purchase foreign oil and, of course, foreign grain.
So what is your solution?
Comrades, we must bear this burden as best we can, improving efficiency at every level of our economy. We can increase production at our other fields and purchase more drilling equipment from the West to explore other known fields. We can restrict supplies available to trucks and personal automobiles. As we all know, there is much waste in this sector. And we can temporarily reduce the amount of fuel consumed by the military and perhaps also divert some heavy machine production from military hardware to necessary industrial areas. We face 3 very hard years, but only 3. Sagatov summarized on an upbeat note, but the defense minister was not impressed.
Comrade, your experience in foreign and defense areas is slim. I will tell you why the situation is unacceptable. If we do what you suggest, the West will learn of our crisis. This will make us vulnerable in their eyes. And at the same time, you propose reducing the fuel available to the forces that defend us against the West.
Comrade Defense Minister, I am an engineer, not a soldier. You asked me for a technical evaluation, and I gave it.
And it has not occurred to you that the West will not allow us to purchase what we need? For the first time, the West has the ability to strangle us in a single year. What if now they also prevent our purchase of grain?
Sergeyev looked around the table. 22 men, of whom only 13 decided matters, and one was missing, were silently contemplating the prospect of over 250 million Soviet workers and peasants, all hungry, in the dark, while the troops of the Red Army, the Minister of the Interior, and the KGB operated on restricted fuel supplies. The men of the Politburo were among the most powerful in the world, far more so than any of their Western counterparts. They answered to no one, not to the Central Committee of the Communist Party, not to the Supreme Soviet, and certainly not to the people of their nation. These were men who had not walked on the streets of Moscow for years, whisked by chauffeured handmade cars to and from their luxury apartments in Moscow. They shopped, if at all, in guarded stores, restricted to the elite, and were served by doctors in clinics only for the elite. The Politburo ruled all, and it was no longer the expression of one man. Each member held his own brand of power. The West never seemed to absorb this idea. Not since Khrushchev had one man held sway. These men regarded themselves as masters of their destiny. The defense minister continued.
We must obtain more oil. It is as simple as that. The alternative is a crippled economy, hungry citizens, and reduced defense capacity. The consequences are not acceptable. Since we cannot purchase oil, we must take it.
Sergeyev looked at the general secretary, the young man, supposed by the West to be fully in charge, the man who was even now changing things. The West still looked to him as hopefully as Sergeyev once had. It was yet another broken dream. The man had been forced to make too many promises, too many deals. He had had to compromise to be in this chair, and he would continue to compromise to remain there. He did not speak. The defense minister continued.
Comrades, the Soviet Union must have oil, at least 200 million tons more than we can produce. Such oil exists only a few hundred kilometers from our border in the Persian Gulf, more oil than we will ever need. We have the ability to take it, but of course there could not fail to be a violent Western response. Those same oil fields supply Western Europe, Japan, and to a lesser extent America. The NATO countries do not have the ability to defend those fields with conventional means. The Americans have their rapid deployment force, a hollow shell of headquarters, and a few light troops. They could not hope to stop our airborne and mechanized forces. Their elite troops would be overwhelmed and exterminated in a few days, and they would be faced with a single alternative, nuclear weapons. This is a real risk that we cannot disregard. Therefore, before we can seize the Persian Gulf, we must first do one other thing. We must eliminate NATO as a political and military force. If NATO is first removed from the board, America will be in a most curious position. The United States will be able to meet its own energy needs from Western Hemisphere sources, removing the need to defend the Arab states, who are in any case not terribly popular with the American Jewish Zionist community. Our objectives must be limited. First, we must engender in America a feeling of security to put them off guard until it is too late for them to react forcefully. Second, we must attempt to unravel the NATO alliance in a political sense. And as you know, the KGB has been working on such a plan, and it is now in final form.
Sergeyev leaned back in his leather chair. So there it was. War was less risky than a cold, hungry peace. It had been decided. Could he dare to speak out against this madness? Perhaps a judicious question first. Do we have the ability to defeat NATO?
What do you think we have an army for? Of course we can defeat NATO. We have already consulted with our senior commanders. I am assured that we can have our army fully ready for combat operations in 4 months. And what will be the status of our fuel supply at that time?
Inventories of light fuels, gasoline and diesel, are high at the moment. Enough for, I would say, we have enough for 45 days. I caution, however, that my staff analysts also feel that all existing estimates of fuel usage in combat conditions are grossly optimistic.
Give us the fuel and we will see it is properly used. My analysts estimate that we can accomplish our goals in 2 weeks, perhaps less. But I grant you the strength of NATO armies and double our estimates to 30 days and we will still have more than enough.
The vote was 11-2 for war. The process had begun. The USS Chicago had been in commission for only 6 weeks, her completion delayed by a yard fire and her commissioning ceremony marred by the absence of the mayor of Chicago due to a strike of city workers. Just back from 5 tough weeks of workups in the Atlantic, the crew was loading provisions for their first operational deployment. Commander Daniel McCafferty was still entranced with his new command and never tired of looking at her. He was walking the mayor along the curved upper deck, the first part of any submarine tour. It was a moment before he reacted. "Excuse me, Mr. Mayor?"
"I said take good care of our ship."
"Oh, yes, sir, but we call subs boats, sir. We'll take good care of her."
"Where are you heading tomorrow, Commander?"
"The sea, sir. The Navy calls it oceanographic research."
Oh, I suppose you'll be counting whales for Greenpeace."
"Well, I can say that there are whales where we're heading."
"What's with the tile on your deck? I never heard of rubber decks on a ship."
"Boat, sir. It's called anechoic tile. Absorbs sound waves. It makes us quieter to operate and makes it harder to detect us on sonar if somebody pings us."
"You're expecting those whales to do some pinging, are you?"
"Well, they are pretty intelligent animals, sir."
"Well, thanks for the tour, Commander, and good luck wherever it is you're going."
Marshal Yuri Rozhkov, Commander-in-Chief of Soviet Ground Forces, greeted his fellow officers at the main entrance of the Officers' Club of the Moscow Military District. It was a massively impressive building dating back to Tsarist times. This was the usual meeting place and the normal time of year for senior field commanders to confer. Shortly after their arrival, they were assembled in the steam baths. Naked but for a pair of towels and a handful of birch branches each, they looked just like any other group of middle-aged men, perhaps a bit fitter than was the average in the Soviet Union. The men all knew one another. Though many were rivals, they were nevertheless members of the same profession, and with an intimacy characteristic of the Russian steam baths, small talk was exchanged for several minutes. Regardless of their personal rivalries, senior officers looked out for the careers of their comrades' sons, and so information was exchanged briefly on whose son was in which command and who wanted advancement to what new posting. Finally came the classically Russian dispute over the strength of the steam. The commander-in-chief, Rozhkov, settled this argument with a thin but steady stream of cold water onto the heated bricks in the center of the room. The resulting hiss would be sufficient to interfere with any listening devices in the room, if the foggy air hadn't already corroded them to junk. Rozhkov had not given the first hint of what was happening. Better, he thought, to shock them into the situation and get candid reactions to the situation at hand.
"Comrades, we launch an offensive against NATO in mid-June. If you are serious, Comrade Marshal, perhaps you will be so kind as to explain the reason for this action."
"You are all aware of this Samotlar oil field disaster. What you have not learned yet are its strategic and political implications. In just over 4 months from now, we shall launch the most crucial military operation in the history of the Soviet Union, the destruction of NATO as a political and military force. And we will succeed."
It took Rozhkov 6 brisk minutes to outline the Politburo's decision. When he finished, he stared at the officers in silence. The commander-in-chief of the Western Theater spoke first.
"I heard the rumors, but things are so bad that we must be ready by mid-June."
"Yes. By then, we must have prepared our plans and our troops."
"Comrades, we have our plan already. We can all be back to our command posts in 6 hours. My opinion is that we can, should, and must attack the imperialists 72 hours from now."
"But we are not ready."
"And neither are they. In fact, they are less ready than we. Their troops are in winter quarters on a winter routine. This is our time to act. We all know that historically the Soviet fighting man performs at his best in winter, and NATO is at its lowest state of readiness. Comrades, how many times have we played this war game? All the maps and formulae we have examined for years, We know the troop and tank concentrations. We know the routes, the highways that we must use, and those that NATO will use. We know our mobilization schedules and theirs. The only thing we don't know is whether our carefully laid plans will in fact work. We should attack at once. Then the unknowns will work against both sides equally. And if our attack goes too well, and NATO relies on a nuclear defense, they might do that anyway. Comrade, all of our plans rely on surprise, no? And if we wait over 4 months, how can we be assured of strategic surprise?
Rozhkov interrupted his two officers. Because our political leadership has promised it. The next morning, the Politburo's foreign minister gave a press conference. Before him, for this rare occasion, was a mob of reporters, backed by their photographers. He hated these damn things, hated the people in front of him. The Western press, with its lack of manners, always prying, always probing, always demanding answers that he need not give to his own people. They were spies. But they could be manipulated, of course, by a skilled man with a collection of carefully prepared disinformation, which was precisely what he was about to do.
Ladies and gentlemen, I will be making a brief statement, and I regret that I cannot answer any questions at this time. A full handout will be given to you as you leave. The President of the United States has often asked for deeds, not words, in the quest for control of strategic arms. As you know, and to the disappointment of the entire world, the ongoing arms negotiations in Vienna have made no significant progress for over a year, with each side blaming the other for the lack of it. It is well known by peace-loving people the world over that the Soviet Union has never wished for war, and that only a madman would even consider nuclear war a viable policy option in our modern world of overkill, fallout, and nuclear winter. The time has come for substantive reductions in strategic arms. We have made numerous serious, sincere proposals for real arms reductions, and despite this, the United States has proceeded with the development and deployment of its destabilizing, openly offensive weapons. And yet they demand Soviet deeds. Tomorrow, the Soviet Union will put on the table at Vienna a proposal to reduce existing arsenals of strategic and theater nuclear weapons by 50%. This reduction to be accomplished over a period of 3 years from ratification of the agreement, subject to on-site verification conducted by third-party inspection teams, whose composition will be agreed upon by all signatories. Please note that I say all signatories. The Soviet Union invites the United Kingdom, the French Republic, and the People's Republic of China to join us at the negotiating table. We have been accused of never making a gesture of our good faith. The falsehood of the charge is manifest, but this evil fiction continues in the West. No longer. No longer will anyone have cause to doubt the sincerity of the Soviet people's quest for a just and lasting peace. Beginning today, as a sign of good faith, the Soviet Union will remove from service an entire class of nuclear-powered missile submarine, known to the West as the Yankee class. We call them something else, of course. We will permit a selected team of 6 American naval officers to inspect these 20 vessels to verify that their missile tubes have been filled with concrete ballast pending removal of the entire missile rooms from all of the submarines. In return for this, we would require that a comparable inspection visit by an equal number of Soviet officers to American yards would be allowed at a later date to be agreed on. Second, as an alternative, if the United States is not willing to allow reciprocal verification of arms reductions, we will permit another group of 6 officers to perform this service. These officers will be from countries agreed upon by the United States and the Soviet Union. Ladies and gentlemen, the time has come to put an end to the arms race. We all know the threat that these ghastly weapons represent to every nation. Let no one ever say again that the government of the Soviet Union has not done its part to reduce the danger of war. Thank you.
American intelligence agencies, like their counterparts throughout the world, monitor all newswire services. Bob Toland at the National Security Agency in Fort Meade, Maryland, was examining the AP reports before most news bureau chiefs. His job was to compare them with the version transmitted over Soviet microwave circuits for publication in Pravda. Toland was a mid-level analyst. He had left the Navy after 6 years, but he had remained an active reservist. His work at the National Security Agency dovetailed nicely with his Naval Reserve Service. He was a communications expert with a degree in electronics. He also had a master's degree in the Russian language. His section chief looked at the AP report with him as it came over the wire, but he was not impressed.
We've been down this road before, huh? The last time things broke down on the issue of mobile missiles. Both sides want them, but both sides are afraid of the other side having them.
I don't know. The tone of this sounds...
Hell, Bob, they're always euphoric about their arms control proposals. You know that.
True, but it's the first time that I know of that the Russians have unilaterally removed a weapons platform from service.
So what? The Yankees are obsolete.
Yeah, but these guys never throw anything away, obsolete or not. Hell, they still have World War II artillery pieces sitting in the warehouses in case they need them again. Now, this is different, and the political ramifications...
We're not talking politics. We're talking nuclear strategy.
And I suppose there's a difference?
Bob Toland worked late that night and went to bed later still. But the next day was Saturday and the first fishing day of the year, so he was up by 4:30 and on the calm waters of the Chesapeake Bay by sunrise. His fishing partner was his father-in-law, Ned Keegan, a former naval officer. Keegan was an academy graduate who had put in his 30 and retired to become a double dipper. In uniform, he'd been an intelligence specialist, and now he had essentially the same job, adding a civil service salary to his pension. Bob Toland had been married to his daughter for 15 years now. You know, Pop, I heard something real interesting last week, but I couldn't convince my boss it meant anything.
You mean Redman?
I worked with him, oh, it must have been 15 years ago. I had to slap him down a few times. He tends to be a little opinionated.
Opinionated? That bastard's so friggin' narrow-minded his scratch pads are only an inch wide. He's already stuck this arms control thing in the files, and I came up with something really unusual last Wednesday that he ignored altogether.
I don't suppose you could tell me what it was.
I shouldn't, but hell, if I can't talk with you, who can I talk to? One of our ferret birds was over a Soviet military district headquarters last week and intercepted a microwave telephone conversation. It was a report to Moscow about four colonels in the Moscow military district who were being shot for falsifying some readiness reports.
Yeah? What Redman say?
He said it was about time they cleaned their act up. And that was that. Hell, Russians don't kill people for jollies. And these four people were experienced line officers with combat experience in Afghanistan. All party members in good standing. It's out of pattern for them. It doesn't make sense.
I agree with you. You got anything else?
Not that I can tie in. The last month over there, there's been a new shortage. Batteries. You can't get a battery for a car or a truck. A lot of cars aren't moving and the batteries are being stolen left and right. People are even taking their batteries out at night and taking them home with them.
Anything on the factory where the batteries are made? It hasn't blown up, has it?
Nope. In fact, they're working three shifts. I got no idea what it means, but something's up, and trying to convince Redman of it is a damn waste of time.
2 weeks later, Lieutenant Commander Robert M. Toland, U.S. Naval Reserve, was placed on special assignment, active duty, by order of the Secretary of Defense. Toland examined himself in the full-sized mirror in the Norfolk officer's barracks. He'd made the drive down the night before. The uniform still fit, he noted, maybe a little tight at the waist, but that was nature at work, wasn't it? His decorations were a bleak row and a half, but he had his service warfare officer's badge, water wings, so he hadn't always been a glorified radio operator. His sleeves bore the 2.5 stripes of a lieutenant commander. 5 minutes later, he was driving down Mitcher Avenue toward headquarters. He was careful to take an unmarked space lest he incur the wrath of a senior officer. A voice called to him.
Bob? Bob Toland!
Damn! Ed Morris, good to see you.
Hey, it's Commander Morris now.
Right, congratulations.
Thanks. The USS Ferris is big, she's beautiful, and she's mine. You should have stayed in, pal.
Hell, the day I took command was like the day my Jimmy was born. I hear you. I always knew you'd have your own ship, and I always knew I wouldn't. Navy still doesn't go for grounding destroyers, know what I mean? I know it wasn't your fault. What are you doing here anyway? Didn't you just do your 2 weeks? Well, I'm on my way to a meeting right now to discuss that very fact. Are you still playing bridge? Are you kidding? Not only am I still playing, I'm still playing with Danny McCafferty. He's here, too. Just got his commission. Brand new sub, the Chicago. Why don't you meet us in the officers' club around 1730? I'll round up a fourth. Great! I haven't seen McCafferty in 2 years. See you, Commander. Bob Toland reported for duty and started getting a look at the information he needed to try and make sense of some of the puzzling events of the last few weeks. Approximately a month ago, four colonels in the Soviet Army, all regimental commanders in mechanized divisions, were court-martialed and executed for falsifying data on their unit training and readiness reports. Earlier this week, Soviet papers publicized the execution of 11 privates. All but two were in the final 6 months of their enlistment period, and all but two were charged with disobeying their sergeants. There was something out of the ordinary about that. A sergeant in the Soviet Army is not a professional soldier as in most armies. He's selected early in his enlistment term for special training due to his intelligence, political reliability, or perceived leadership ability. He gets a tough 6-month training course to make him an instant sergeant, then he returns to his unit. The real pecking order of the Soviet ground formations does not necessarily derive from rank, but from time in service. So these privates, in the last quarter of their training, were shot for disobeying orders that came from sergeants who would normally hold little power over privates with this length of service. It appeared that times were changing in the Soviet Union, and this was not the only evidence he saw of it. Surface-to-surface missiles were up 70% from last year. Submarine deployments, mainly those for diesel subs, were down, and there were an unusually high number of submarines in the yards for what appeared to be routine but unscheduled maintenance. It appeared likely that all Soviet submarines were undergoing battery replacement, but factory production of batteries was up and civilian usage down. He also noted higher levels of activity by Soviet naval surface forces, naval aviation units, and other long-range aircraft formations with increased weapons exercises. Operational patterns were different from what he'd seen before. His first impression was that Soviet military readiness was being increased across the board. He still didn't see anything that would tell him why. It was just after midnight when the truck drove north across Red Square, turning right towards the Kremlin. They stopped for the first group of Kremlin guards. Their papers were fully in order, of course, and they were waved through. Their truck pulled up to the second checkpoint.
What are you delivering this time of day, comrades?
Cleaning supplies. Come, I'll show you. Here.
German supplies?
Da. The Krauts make very efficient cleaning machinery, and we make very good use of it. This is carpet cleaning fluid. This is for lavatory walls. This for windows.
Yes, I see. But tell me, comrade, why do you deliver them at this hour?
Orders. Open one of the cans. That one.
What? Oh, that one. That one is the worst smelling of all. Stand back. I don't want to splash your clean uniform.
Oh, shit!
I warned you, comrade captain, but it will come out of the uniform. Be sure you have it dry cleaned soon. It's an acid solution. It could damage the wool.
The captain waved to a private and walked off. The private unlocked the door, allowing the driver and his assistant to go in. They used a hand truck to take the cans of cleaning fluid inside, taking the elevator to the third floor. There they shut the power off and moved their delivery to a storage room directly below the fourth floor conference room. They had memorized the blueprints of the building. They took the cans with the false tops and set them aside. The charges were attached to the wall pillars of the outside corners of the room. The detonators were attached. The driver took the electronic triggering device and put it in his pocket. He checked his watch, then activated the timers. 2 minutes later, they were out of the building.
Bob Toland was awakened at 2:30 in the morning by a call from the officer on duty.
Sorry to wake you, Lieutenant, but I think you better get over here. We just caught a live news report that says the Kremlin has been hit by terrorists.
Jeez. I'll be right there.
The officer on duty was taping the cable news network report when Toland reached him. Nothing on the wire services yet?
Not yet, sir, but let me show you this.
This is Rich Sudler coming to you live from the Kremlin. There has been an explosion in the Council of Ministers building here in Moscow. At approximately 9:30 this morning, Moscow time, I was taping a report when a thundering sound came from the building behind me here. In just seconds, the square was filled with running men in uniform and official cars. Now, at that point, the militia captain who had been escorting us... The militia is the Soviet equivalent of, a U.S. state police force. The captain made us stop taping and confiscated our tape cassette. We were not allowed to tape the fire trucks or the armed troops who arrived and who are now guarding the whole area. But the tape was returned to us, and we can now give you this live picture of what went on here tonight as we were getting ready to tape our report.
As the tape began to roll, Toland watched the newsman reporting on tourism in the Soviet Union. As he gestured in one direction, in the other there was a massive explosion. The cameraman had obviously turned toward the sound, and after a moment's wobble, the lens settled on a ball of dust and smoke expanding up and away from this portion of the Kremlin's complex of buildings. A second later, the zoom lens darted in on the scene. There was one body, perhaps another, along with a collection of automobiles crushed by the debris. The tape abruptly ended. The news continued.
The Kremlin guards' reaction is just what you might imagine, a mixture of horror and rage. But I do want to make it clear that that is not being directed against anyone, certainly not against Americans. So, to summarize what we know to this point, there has been a bombing incident within the Kremlin walls, possibly an attempt to eliminate the Soviet Politburo, though I must emphasize we are not certain of that. We have had it confirmed by police at the scene that at least 3 people are dead, with 40 others wounded and taken to nearby hospitals. This is Rich Sudler, CNN, coming to you live from the Kremlin.
Holy shit. And nothing on the wire services? I want you to call CNN in Atlanta and find out how long this Sudler guy's been trying to tape his story on tourism. Find out how much lead time he had, when this was approved, who he worked through to get it, and if someone other than his regular press contact gave the approval. Yes, sir, right away.
2 hours later, they knew little more about the reporter, but much more about the incident. By that time, the KGB had arrested a West German national and accused him of setting off the bomb. He had missed the Politburo members, but among the victims were 6 young children scheduled to make a presentation to their leaders. Toland knew it had to be a setup. It took 12 minutes before the tanks and infantry carriers were atop the hill. The Soviet training exercise was over. Sergeyev, on business from the Politburo, was observing General Alexeyev's troops. Nicely done, Comrade General. As I recall, the standard for this particular drill is 14 minutes. The tanks and infantry vehicles cooperated well. Never seen the use of armed helicopters, but that too was impressive.
Thank you, sir. The improvement since January is remarkable. Our men are fit. They have been drilling in their tasks continuously. I would prefer another 2 months, but I think I can inform you honestly that we are ready.
Comrade General, when you say we are ready, do you mean that we will win?
If we have strategic surprise, and if the Politburo succeeds in splitting NATO, then yes, I believe we should win.
I notice, Comrade, that you do not say we will surely win.
On the field of battle, Comrade Minister, there are no certainties. Fighting a war is not an exercise in mathematics. We deal with people, not numbers. Numbers have their own special kind of perfection. People remain people, no matter what we try to do with them.
That is good, General Alexeyev. I have found an honest man in you. That is important. I have a son. He is ending his first year of graduate school in languages, top of his class, Middle Eastern languages. He will serve the Red Army when he leaves university. I know that too few children of high party officials do this, but I believe that those who would rule must first serve.
Comrade Minister, we are in agreement on this point.
And I myself can always use good men. You can be sure of that.
Then I will return to take care of this matter and to confirm that your work here is going well.
Thank you, Comrade Minister.
Behind him were a row of small caskets, open, showing six small bodies, one with a cloth covering the face. As the chairman of the Politburo spoke, Bob Tolan translated the tape to his senior officer.
Comrades, we see before us the innocent children of our nation, killed by the infernal engine of state terrorism, killed by a nation that has twice defiled our motherland with unholy dreams of conquest and murder. We see before us the dedicated, humble servants of our party who ask nothing more than to serve the state. We see martyrs to the security of the Soviet Union. We see martyrs to the aggression of fascists. Comrades, to the families of these innocent children and to the families of these three fine men, I say that a reckoning will come. I say that their deaths will not be forgotten. I say that there will be justice for this vicious crime.
Tolan stopped the tape and looked over his shoulder.
Geez, I'm telling you, these people aren't going to settle for anything less than a war. Everything about this whole incident has been run to inflame the Russian population.
Well, we're calling up the reserves, Tolan, but it's still hard to believe. I mean, deliberately murdering children just to create a crisis?
It's just unthinkable, even for them. Well, we can either believe it was deliberate or we can believe that the West German government has decided to take on the Soviet Union by themselves. And that, if you don't mind my saying so, would be totally fucking crazy. But why? Why would they do it? That's the problem with this job. I can tell you what, but it's a lot harder to find out why. Their foreign minister has a news conference scheduled for tomorrow morning. Maybe we can get some sense of this from whatever he has to say.
Ladies and gentlemen, a year that has gone so well for East-West relations has turned to ashes in the mouths of all of us. Our efforts have been brought to ruin by a handful of men who have not taken the lessons of the Second World War to heart. We have in our possession classified German documents that prove that the West German government planned to bring down the Soviet government and use the resulting period of internal confusion to achieve their aim of remaking Germany into the principal continental power in Europe yet again. All Europeans know what that would mean to world peace. We know that the rearming of Germany by the West, supposedly a defensive measure against the imagined threat from the East, was the first step in the West's own plan to unify Germany as a pawn to counterbalance the Soviet Union. That this was a foolish and unnecessary policy is now manifestly clear. The Federal Republic of Germany has evidently turned on her Western allies, planning to use the NATO alliance as a shield behind which to launch her own offensive operations, whose objective can only upset the balance that has safeguarded the peace in Europe for two generations. Although we can fault the West for creating this situation, the government of the Soviet Union does not, I repeat, does not hold America or her NATO allies responsible for this. My country has learned the bitter lesson that allies can turn on their supposed friends, much as a dog can turn on his master. But the Soviet Union cannot ignore, cannot set aside the fact that a deliberate act of aggression has been made against the Soviet Union on Soviet soil. We demand that the Bonn government immediately demobilize its army to a level consistent with maintenance of the civil peace. We further call upon the Bonn government to admit its aggressive action, to dissolve and call for new elections so that the German people themselves may judge how well they have been served. And we demand and expect that full reparations be paid to the government of the Soviet Union and to the families of those murdered. Failure to meet with these demands will have the gravest possible consequences. That is all I have to say.
The Soviet Spetsnaz team left the safe house in two small vans, driving south on the road to Lammersdorf, where NATO communications are based. They were quiet and tense. The officer had taken pains to explain to his men that their escape had been carefully planned, that once clear of the target, they'd get to another safe house and wait for their Red Army comrades to arrive in 5 days. They were the cream of the Red Army, he told them, thoroughly trained to carry out dangerous missions behind enemy lines and hence very valuable to the state. Every man had combat experience fighting in the mountains of Afghanistan. They were trained. They were ready. The men accepted the speech, as elite troopers usually do, in total silence. Chosen for their intelligence most of all, each of them knew that the speech was merely that. Their mission depended largely on luck. The drivers were KGB agents well experienced at working in foreign lands. Both the vehicles stayed together, driving conservatively, wary of vehicles that followed them. Each had a scanner tuned to the local police frequencies and another for communicating with each other. They were now in a rural part of western Germany, driving southeast through the German-Belgian Nature Park, a scenic route often traveled by tourists and sightseers. They had chosen this side road to avoid the military traffic on the major highways, but as they passed through Mulatswitter, the lead driver suddenly found himself behind a military convoy of tanks on low-hauler trailers. Strange, he thought, the tanks are loaded backwards, with their guns facing... The convoy halted suddenly, bringing the two Soviet vans to a halt. It was an ambush. A voice called to them in Russian.
Attention! Spetsnaz soldiers, attention! You are surrounded by a company of mechanized troops. Come out of your vehicles in single file and throw down your weapons. If you open fire, you will be killed within seconds.
The Soviet commandos exchanged looks of horror. Although they were under order not to be taken alive, their leader ordered them out of the vans one at a time, with their hands held high. It went quickly. A joint team of NATO Special Air Service commandos handcuffed their prisoners and led them off. Only the leader remained. He stepped out carrying a live grenade. The truck exploded, and with it, the group's leader, the maps, and the plans for escape. But this was not the only Spetsnaz group, and not every NATO communications site had gotten the word in time. A score of firefights erupted on both sides of the Rhine. A war to involve millions began with these small squadrons fighting desperate actions in the dark. The pilots relished the mission. They were skimming north at a perilously low level over the terrain of East Germany. Lockheed called her the Ghost Rider. The pilots called her the Frisbee, the F-19A, the secretly developed attack fighter. She had no corners, no box shapes to allow radar signals to bounce cleanly off her. To the enemy, the Frisbee didn't seem to exist at all. The targets were bridges that crossed the River Elbe. At the moment, they were covered with Russian T-80 tanks, all heading west. This was the second echelon of the Soviet army deployed to attack NATO. South of the bridges, a SAM battery commander was trying to decide what the noise was. His search radar did not show the Frisbee.
We're approaching target. ETA is 1 minute. Roger. Anything locked on us? Not yet. Coming up on the target. 30 seconds. Illuminate the target. The target is lit. No radar on us yet. 15 seconds. Okay, let's make this one count. Tally-ho!
The Soviet SAM commander blanched as he realized what just appeared from nowhere onto his scopes. He salvoed 3 missiles in return. The first SAM struck and exploded on the high-tension power lines that spanned the river just south of the bridges. The entire valley was strobe-lighted as the power lines fell sparking into the river. The other 2 SAMs raced to the second Frisbee in formation and struck it broadside, blowing it to pieces 3 seconds after it had obliterated a pair of Soviet radar vehicles. The operation lasted only 27 minutes. When it was over, 30 of the 36 bridges had been destroyed and the rest damaged. 2 of the priceless Frisbees and 11 strike aircraft had been lost. But the NATO air forces had fulfilled their most crucial mission. The much-feared Soviet ground superiority was decisively reduced. The land battle for Western Europe would now be fought on nearly even terms. However, that was not the situation in Iceland.
Anyone on this net, this is Mike Edwards, First Lieutenant, United States Air Force, transmitting from Iceland. Please acknowledge, over. Anyone on this net, this is Mike Edwards, Second Lieutenant, United States Air Force, over.
Sender on this net, please identify, over.
Edwards, Michael D., Second Lieutenant, U.S. Air Force, serial number 328-61-4030. I'm the meteorological officer attached to the 48th Fighter Interceptor Squadron at Keflavik, Iceland. Who is this? Over.
If you don't know that, pal, you don't belong on this net. Clear off. We need this for official traffic. Over and...
Listen up, asshole. The guy who knows how to work this damn radio is dead, and I'm all you got. The base at Keflavik was hit 7 hours ago by a Russian air and ground attack. The place is crawling with bad guys, and there's a Russian ship coming into harbor right now, and you're playing fucking word games? Let's get it together, mister. Over.
Copy that. Stand by. We have to verify who you are.
Damn it, this thing works on batteries. You want me to run them down while you open a file cabinet? Look, Turkey, I'm sitting here on Hill 152. I got two Marines with me. The Russians have invaded this rock and pounded the hell out of Keflavik. They've got troops all over the place.
Okay, Edwards, let's play it cool. Give me the details. What can you see from there?
We've got some Russian vehicles heading west toward Keflavik, and some trucks. We can't tell what kind. They're heading northeast on Highway 41. Looks like that ship in the harbor's unloading more of the same.
Roger, copy. From now on, your code name is Beagle. We are Doghouse. Continue your report.
Roger, Doghouse. Looks like they got six single-seat aircraft sitting at the end of Runway 4. They look like fighters.
Roger, six possible fighters. Unless you've got something more, Beagle, we've got to get this upstairs. Stay where you are.
Roger, that's a copy. We'll be here. Out.
The loss of Iceland was a disaster whose dimensions would soon be apparent. The Soviet bombers now had a clear lane to reach into the trade route. Their submarines began racing through the Denmark Strait as the NATO navies raced to position their submarines to form a barrier upon which the NATO convoys could depend. One of the ships in that convoy was the USS Faris, the carrier assigned to Commander Ed Morris. Morris's crew had been port and starboard for almost a week now. 4 hours on duty, 4 hours off. Sleep patterns were broken up, and crucial maintenance requirements cut into what sleep allocations his men had. On top of this was the knowledge that a submarine or aircraft attack could come at any time. When the warning came, it was the 24th time on their voyage that the Faris's crew raced to battle stations.
I think this one's for real, Captain.
How's the plot look? Still a question of distance, sir. I can give you a working range figure of 42 to 45,000 yards, bearing 340 to 336. We've got a confirmation that there are no friendly subs in the area? No friendlies in the area confirmed, sir. Range is firming up. Estimate target speed roughly 8 knots, distance 43,000 yards. Okay, patience. Let's lock this guy in before we fire.
Contact. Positive sonar contact, sir. Direct path. Nail him. He's changing course, sir. Target is turning and increasing speed. We've got a torpedo in the water and pinging. I think the torp may have him, sir. All right, we have impact. We got that sucker. Coming up. Target is coming up. We have bubbles on the surface. Hot damn, there he is.
The forward hatch opened and men began scrambling out. More appeared on the sail, jumping overboard as the submarine's engine room filled with water. A total of 10 got off before the submarine slid backwards below the waves. The helicopters dropped life jackets to the men in the water. No one had seriously considered this possibility. A torpedo hit on a submarine was supposed to kill her entirely. Prisoners, Morris thought to himself. What the hell am I supposed to do with prisoners? He saluted the Soviet captain like an arriving dignitary. The Russian's reaction was one of astonishment. Morris looked around briefly to see the incredulous expressions on his crew's faces.
Captain, no offense, sir, but what are we doing here? Hell if I know. This wasn't supposed to happen. Take them to sick bay. Separate the officers from the enlisted and the senior enlisted men from the juniors. Keep them separate. Keep them comfortable. Everybody gets new clothes. I figure we'll treat them nice and maybe one or two will spill his guts. I can't remember if I read this in the manual or a spy novel. Let's give it a try anyway.
Yes, sir.
And if you know anyone who managed to get a bottle on board, get it. I want to serve them a couple of stiff drinks tonight at dinner.
Dinner was awkward, to say the least. The three Russian officers at the end of the table ate with two armed guards 10 feet away and watched the cook, who conspicuously kept a large knife in view. Morris attempted to break the ice. So, any of you speak English?
I do. I am instructed by Captain to thank you for rescue our men.
Tell your captain that the war has rules, but so does the sea. And ask him if he would like more food. How is the food aboard a Soviet submarine?
Good, but not the same. We eat different foods. Fish, not meat. We have tea, no coffee.
Yeah? We got tea if you like. Excuse me. An enlisted man entered the wardroom and handed Morris a message form. The sailor had taken the time to print the message on a standard message form so that no one would suspect anything. The message read, "The special job is done." It meant that the Russians' accommodations were all bugged now. Morris dismissed his man with a nod and pocketed the form. His bosun had miraculously discovered 4 bottles of hard liquor. They were probably from the chef's quarters, but Morris knew better than to inquire. The bottles would find their way to the Russians tonight. He hoped the liquor would loosen their tongues before the helicopter came to pick them up. In Iceland, Lieutenant Edwards and his men had been ordered by Doghouse to move Beagle to a new hill. Edwards tried to take some solace in having predicted the weather correctly. The rain had started with a few sprinkles. 2 minutes later, it was falling heavily, cutting visibility down to a few hundred yards. They had spotted a farmhouse and were discussing the possibility of shelter and food when they saw a vehicle pulling into the drive.
What gives, sir?
Looks like we got 5 Ruskies. They're looking in the windows, and one just kicked the door in. I don't like the looks of it. Damn! Let's move in a little. Stay together and stay alert.
Why are we moving in, sir?
'Cause I say so.
Hell, I don't want to wait. Let's get in there. You start firing as soon as you hit the door, and watch out for the civilians. Let's go!
You okay, Skipper? Shit, we got fucking 5 dead Ruskies and I'm supposed to be a weatherman. Watch out! I think I heard something. Take it slow. Hold it, motherfucker! I'm sorry, ma'am. It's okay, it's okay. We won't hurt you. A beautiful young woman stood before them, wearing a nightdress that had been torn apart. Her body was red and bruised. Beyond her in the kitchen, Edward saw the unmoving legs of another woman. He moved past her and into the room, where he saw a dog and a man, also dead.
It's okay now, ma'am. We won't hurt you. I'm sorry we weren't faster. I know this is going to be hard for you. I know you're...
Ma'am, do you speak English?
Yes. Listen, I know you probably won't want to leave here, but we've got to get away. Now, they'll send someone to look for these men. You sit down. I'll get you some clothes, and then we've got to get you out of here.
Private, I'll load these guys into their jeep. We'll see if we can fake an accident and torch it. Get some liquor bottles, and we'll make it look like they were drinking. Pick up anything else you think we can use, too. I think we better torch the house, then get our asses as far from here as we can. Those Ruskies aren't going to like this one.
Doghouse ain't going to like it either, sir.
The information on Iceland came in on the telex one confusing piece at a time. Bob Toland was attempting to complete his report before the newly assigned admiral arrived.
Toland, I understand you're preparing a report to bring me up to date.
Yes, sir, although the information coming in from Iceland is a little sketchy. We were getting an eyeball report from an Air Force officer who survived the attack, but we lost contact with him last night. The Royal Air Force sent 2 Reese birds in for a look-see. The first one got good shots of Keflavik and the surrounding area, but the second one didn't make it back, reason unknown. I'd say Sam's would be a good bet. Icelandic radio and TV are off the air. The British report contact with ham operators on the Icelandic coast, but nothing at all is coming out of the southwest corner of the island, where most of the people are. It looks like it's completely under Soviet control. We're getting some information, but it can't last.
We doing any better in Norway?
Afraid not, sir. They're not only chewing the Norwegians up, they're driving them south. Most of the attacks are on the northern bases, and they're not giving them any breather at all. They've had an air battle going on for almost 20 hours now, with heavy losses on both sides.
Jesus, you got any good news, Toland?
Not really, sir. Nothing much is happening in the Pacific yet. The Soviets are putting a lot of diplomatic pressure on Japan. They're giving them the same story as the rest of the world. It's a German plot.
I can't believe it. Why would Japan go along with that horse shit?
The Russians are promising them the Sakhalin Islands back if they play ball, and they're promising to pound the hell out of them if they don't. The bottom line is, Japan isn't allowing any bases on its soil to be used for offensive strikes against the Soviet Union. We really underestimated the political dimension here, sir. So far, their scheme is working just like they wanted. The Turks aren't about to attack Russia on their own hook, and Greece is staying out of what they call this German-Russian dispute. So far, the Soviets are only fighting in Western Europe and against selected American installations. Of course, they're telling anyone who listened that they don't want to fight us.
Right. So how are they not fighting us in Germany so far?
Well, as you probably know, they've run Spetsnaz commando troops all over the country. For the most part, they've been defeated. We got information on that plan before it went into operation, though I have to admit it was purely accidental. One of their KGB agents stepped off a curb and got hit by a car out of control. The officer on the scene uncovered some papers that helped us out. Our guys were ready for them for the most part. We took some losses, but those Spetsnaz troops got chewed up in most cases.
Well, I'm glad we could end this meeting on a high note, Toland. I gotta get settled in. Look, I'll be back for the afternoon briefing. If you get anything you think I should know before then, consider the fact that I haven't had any sleep in 48 hours.
Right, sir. Commander Daniel X. McCafferty was still somewhat entranced with his new command, the USS Chicago, the Navy's newest and, he thought, finest submarine. He had been conducting its first few weeks of workups in the Atlantic when he had got the order to go to the Barents Sea.
It's going to be a busy day, troops. We got a pair of Bear Fs, one due north, the other west. Both are a good way off, but you can bet they're dropping sono buoys to search us out. XO, take her back down to 500 feet, speed 5 knots. We'll let them come to us.
Aye, sir. Skipper, I may have a bearing. I just copied 6 pings from a low-frequency sonar. I think that's him, bearing 039. Trying to isolate his engine signature now, sir. I think it's a Kirov. We've got some sono buoys dropping to the right. Take her up to 200 feet. We'll listen above the lair for a few minutes.
Yes, sir.
Sir, we've got a direct path to the targets, and we're due for another sono buoy drop. This one might be close. I'm classifying this contact as the Soviet cruiser Kirov. Sir, we have a medium-frequency active sonar bearing 331, maneuvering left to right. This second contact looks like the Soviet Cresta II.
Okay, let's get through that line of buoys. All ahead, one-third, come left, 321.
Torpedoes in the water, 320.
Geez, I think somebody's attacking our target, sir.
Skipper, it looks like somebody got inside on him and launched an attack. He got 3 solid hits on Kirov and... Another torpedo in the water, sir. McCafferty took the periscope and swept the horizon. The smoke was clearing. He could now see 4 ships, 1 hull down. Sir, we have a destroyer heading in.
Energize and give me 2 sweeps.
The radar was on for a total of 12 seconds. It painted a total of 26 targets on the screen. The radar operator read off ranges and bearing. These were entered into the control and relayed to the harpoon missiles in the torpedo tubes, giving them bearing to target and the range at which to switch on their seeker heads. The weapons officer checked his status lights, then located the most promising targets. McCafferty shouted the order.
Flood tubes! Open outer doors!
Solution checked and valid, sir. Firing sequence 213.
Shoot!
Fire 2. Fire 1. Fire 3. 2, 1, and 3 fired, sir. Torpedo tube doors are shut, pumping out to reload. Let's get the hell out of here. We got a Helix heading in. Take her down. All ahead flank, left full rudder. Left full rudder high. Passing through 100 feet, speed 15 knots, sir. McCafferty swore to himself. He'd done everything right. gotten through the outer Soviet defenses, and had a clear idea of how to duck the destroyers, but someone had gotten to that Kirov first and messed up his approach. His three harpoons might have found targets, but he couldn't monitor them now without putting himself in danger. He wrote up his report and wondered why things were going the way they were. A helicopter took Alexeyev to Roshkov's command post just outside of Stendal in the German Democratic Republic. The flight was bad enough, but Alexeyev did not like what he found when he arrived at the underground bunker. The staff officers present were too concerned with what the NATO forces were doing and not concerned enough with what the Red Army was supposed to be doing to them. Roshkov took Alexeyev into his office. Comrade Alexeyev, what is the NATO situation in your opinion? My opinion, sir, would be better founded if I were at the front and not here for meetings. We have three attacks underway. I need to see how they are going. Our deepest penetration to date is just over 100 kilometers. The timetable has gone completely to hell. Losses are far higher than expected on both sides, but worse for us. We have gravely underestimated the lethality of NATO anti-tank weapons. Our artillery has been unable to suppress them enough for our forces to make a major breakthrough. We must find a weakness in NATO lines and launch a major coordinated attack soon. How soon do you wish to visit the front? Within the hour. I will take Captain Sergeyev with me. Minister Sergeyev's son? Too dangerous. What if he's hurt?
Hurt?
We are at war. He is an officer in the Soviet army, whatever his father might be. And he is a skilled officer. I need him.
Very well. Keep me posted on where you are. We have to get control of this whorehouse.
A lifetime of military service had not prepared him for the destruction that lay on the landscape below him. As Alexeyev and the younger Sergeyev crossed the border into West Germany, they saw charred remains of aircraft, vehicles, and men that had transformed the neat, picturesque German countryside into a junkyard of high-technology weapons. Alexeyev realized that a whole regiment of tanks had been lost in a 10-kilometer advance down a single road. He began to see NATO equipment. Tanks, infantry carriers, and a German helicopter identifiable only from the tail rotor that stuck out from the ashes. For both sides, the proud vehicles manufactured at the greatest expense and skill were scattered on the landscape like trash thrown from a car window.
Welcome, Comrade General. Captain?
Where is the divisional commander?
Killed day before yesterday by enemy artillery fire. We have to move twice a day now. They are becoming very skilled at locating us.
What about concealment?
Ask the devil's mother why it doesn't work. NATO tactics are to go for the unit commanders, and the bastards are good at it. Every time we approach a village, my tanks have to fight through a swarm of missiles. We've tried rockets and artillery to suppress them, but you can't take the time to blast every building in sight. We'd never get anywhere.
What do you need?
Air support, and lots of it. Get me the support to smash through what's opposing me, and I'll give you your damn breakout.
Your supply situation?
It could be better. Not enough to support an intact division.
And what are your plans now?
We'll launch a two-regiment attack just over an hour from now. Another village, Biben. Same one we tried to get last night. They command the crossroads we need. If you wish to observe, General, we'd better get you forward. I'll get you an infantry carrier. Your helicopter would be useless unless you wish to die. It will be a dangerous trip.
Fine, comrade. We will expect you to protect us. When do we leave?
The USS Ferris slowed, coming off a 25-knot sprint to commence another drift maneuver, allowing her sonar to listen for hostile submarines. Commander Ed Morris was in his bridge chair going over messages from shore. He rubbed his eyes and lit up another Pall Mall.
Commander, bridge! I got a periscope feather on the port bow, halfway to the horizon. Port bow! Passive sonar contact, sir. Evaluate as possible submarine bearing 013. We're picking up steam noises. Sounds like a possible nuke. Less than 5 minutes, sir. If this is a sub, we're up against a good one. Right. Let's get the helo on them right now. I got a weak signal on number 6 and a medium on number 4. Contact, bearing 015, positive submarine contact, Victor class, bearing changing rapidly left to right.
Morris wanted to maneuver but decided against it. A radical turn would cause his towed array sonar to curve and render it useless for several minutes. The operator pointed at his screen. Morris was surprised. The contact bearing had been changing rapidly, but was now steadied down. The helicopter made another pass. A new sonobuoy made another drop, but the noise level from it was fading. Then, suddenly, a bright orange glow came on the sonar scope. Morris shouted, "Left full rudder! Combat, what about the contact?" "I don't know what happened, sir. We lost it." "Sir, we're going to take a hit!" There was nothing Morris could do. The torpedo was approaching on his port bow. If he turned right, he would only give it a larger target. Morris leaned over the rail, staring at it with mute rage as it kept extending like a finger towards his bow. The white wake kept getting closer. The impact lifted Morris a foot off the steel deck. An instant after he bounced off the steel a second time, he was deluged with a sheet of white water. His first thought was that he had been thrown overboard. He rose to see his executive officer, headless, slumped against the pilot house door. The bridge wing was torn apart, the stout metal shielding ripped by fragments. What he saw next was worse. The torpedo struck the frigate just aft of the bow-mounted sonar. Already the bow had collapsed, the keep sundered by the explosion. The horrible groaning of metal told him that the bow was ripped off his ship. Morris lifted a sound-powered phone and twisted the dial.
"Damage control report. Floating aft to frame 36, sir, but I think she'll float. For a little while, anyway. No fires. Waiting for reports now. Combat, radio the screen commander that we've taken a hit and need assistance." "Done, sir. There's a tug on the way. Looks like the sub got away. They're still searching for her. We have some shock damage here. All the radars are down. Bow sonar is out."
The USS Ferris lay dead in the water. An hour later, the tug was pulling the frigate on an easterly course at 4 knots, backwards to protect the damaged bow. Morris ordered his towed array sonar to be strung over the bow, paling it out behind to give them some small defense capability. Numerous extra lookouts were posted to watch for periscopes. It would be a slow, dangerous trip back home. It was their third trip to the front. Alexeyev warned Sergeyev that they had only minutes before the operation would begin. 4 motor rifle divisions were online, covering less than 20 kilometers. Behind them, a tank division waited to exploit the first breach in German lines. The objective was the Alfeld, where 2 roads were being used by NATO to shuttle units and supplies north and south. Its capture would open a breach in the NATO lines, allowing the Soviet operational maneuver groups to burst into NATO's rear. 30,000 feet over the Rhine, 2 NATO radar aircraft were fighting for their lives. A determined Soviet attack was underway against each. Heedless of their own safety, the Russians were coming west at over 1,000 miles per hour with heavy jamming support. American F-15 Eagles and French Mirage jets converged on the threat, filling the sky with missiles. It was not enough. For the first time, the Soviets were achieving air superiority over a major battlefield. Alexeyev checked his watch. It was time. There was a roar overhead, and the general saw the leading elements of the ground attack fighters racing to the front. Behind them, the commander of the 8th Guards Army stood quietly, watching his plan of attack unfold.
"Comrades, our lead elements are moving in now, meeting moderate resistance. Enemy artillery and tank fire is being encountered.
Officer, report."
"Our fighters are engaging NATO aircraft. Damn! Friendly SAMs are shooting down our fighters."
"Air defense officer, tell your units to identify their targets."
"General, we have 50 aircraft over the front. We don't need the SAMs to handle NATO."
"Then tell all SAM batteries to hold fire on all targets above 1,000 meters.
Enemy units retreating in disarray. The 143rd reports they have broken through German lines. They are not regrouping. They are not attempting to turn."
"Officer, get that tank division moving."
The 2 understrength German brigades covering this sector had suffered too much, had been called upon to stop too many tactics. Their men spent, their weapons depleted, they had no choice but to run from the enemy, hoping to form a new line. Since the war began, the Soviet army had been trying to break one of these power units. It was now possible, although with the initial attack a success, the most difficult part of the battle was underway. The Soviets had to move their units forward rapidly to reach Alfeld by nightfall. Units established pre-planned traffic control points, moving down roads whose marker signs had been removed. This was not easy, and the units were not intact. Some commanders were dead, vehicles had broken down, and damaged roads slowed traffic well below normal rates of advance.
Dan McCafferty, the commander of the USS Chicago, was having a drink with Todd Sims, the commander of the USS Boston. They had pulled into port at Fastlane, Scotland. McCafferty was relaying his ill luck at sea.
So right after the war order comes in, see, we got bounced by a Norwegian P-3. The bastard dropped on us. We detected something on the northern edge of our patrol area, but it disappeared. And then we got our big chance against that amphibious group. Things are going perfect, you know? The Russians had their sonobuoy lines out, and we beat them clean. Just about the time we get our targets lined up for the missile attack, somebody else launches his own torpedo attack. It screwed everything up. We lofted three harpoons, but a helo saw us do it, and bingo. We had the bastards all over us. Ah, I need a drink.
That sounds good to me. Everything looks better after a few beers. Hey, that sort of thing happens, Danny. For crying out loud, let up on yourself. Not your fault they didn't give you any targets. Hey, bartender, two strong ones.
McCafferty took a long pull on his mug of warm, dark beer. Sims picked up the bill and led his friend to a corner booth. 2 miles away, the Chicago was reprovisioning. Boston and another 688-class sub were tied to the same quay. Another pair was due in later that day. They were being outfitted for a special mission, but they didn't know yet what it was. In the meantime, the officers and crewmen were using their free time to breathe fresh air and unwind. McCafferty didn't especially feel like listening to the Norwegian sailor behind them, who was the life of the party and obviously drunk.
I must find the man who saved us. We blasted the Kirov all the way back to Murmansk. This is how it was. We make our approach slowly. Then they come right to us, and we creep in very slow. I put periscope up, and there he is. 4,000 meters, 20 knots. He will pass within 500 meters starboard. Arnie,
where are you?
Arnie is a weapons officer. He's set to fire 4 torpedoes. The Kirov is very close now. Our periscope, course same, speed same. Distance now 2,000 meters. I shoot 1, 2, 3, 4, reload.
You're the guy that ruined my approach.
And who, sir, are you?
Dan McCafferty, USS Chicago.
You were there?
Yes, I was there.
You shoot missiles?
Yes, I shoot missiles.
Hero! You save my men. You save my ship.
What?
The Russians come to us with cruiser, 2 destroyers. We evade, go deep, but they find us and fire rockets. Many, many rockets. Most far, some close. We reload and I shoot cruiser Cresta, I think, but not sure.
We classified it as a Cresta. You hit her?
One hit. Hurt, but not sing. This was a very busy time.
Yeah, it was for us, too. We came in fast, flipped on the radar. There were 3 ships where we thought Kirov was.
Oh, Kirov was sunk. Blow up. What you see was Cresta cruiser, Udaloy, and Sovremeny destroyers. Then you shoot missiles, yes?
Yeah, 3 harpoons. A Helix saw the launch and came after us. We evaded and never knew if the missiles hit anything.
My ship dead, my men dead, I dead, but you kill. Udaloy, 1,000 meters to port, Sovremeny, 1,000 meters starboard, Cresta in middle, boom, boom, boom. You sure? I'm sure. Sovremeny blow up, Udaloy hit but not sink, Cresta hit. My crew is alive because of you, Chicago. I buy you drink. I buy all your men drink.
I think we might just take you up on that.
As ordered by Doghouse, Edwards and his party had moved camp to the top of a 2,000-foot hill. They had covered 15 kilometers in the past 10 hours.
A sparkling river below them fed into the fjord, more than 10 miles away. Everyone kept low, with a low sun behind them. Edwards broke out the radio. Doghouse, this is Beagle. We've reached our objective.
What kind of shape are you in?
If you want us to go any further, fella, this radio might malfunction.
Roger, copy that. If you see any, repeat any Russian activity, we want to know about it immediately. One guy taking a leak against a rock, we want to know about it. Do you copy that?
Roger, you want the size in inches. No Ruskies in view yet. Some ruins to our left and a farm a ways downriver from us. Nothing moving at either place. Any particular location you want us?
We're working on that. Sit tight for the moment, find a nice place to hide and stay put. How's the woman making out?
She's not holding us up, Henny, if that's what you mean. And she knows the area.
Roger, what's your food situation?
We have enough fish to last out the day, and I can see a lake where we might get some more. How about having some pizza sent out, Doghouse? Pepperoni and onions?
Fish is good for you. Beagle, your signal strength is down. You want to start thinking about conserving your batteries.
Roger, we'll get back to you if we see anything. Out. Doghouse had never really expected Edwards and his party to make it this far, not with 8,000 Russian troops now on the island. Every time he thought about them trekking over the bare, rocky ground and Soviet helicopters circling overhead, his skin crawled. He'd get someone in as soon as he could. Until then, he'd keep relaying Edwards' reports. Alexeyev and Sergeyev had watched 8 hours of vicious fighting to stop the counterattack. Their men had stopped the enemy for the present, but that was not enough. They had only advanced 6 kilometers before running into a solid wall of tanks and missiles. Alexeyev thought, "We have to hit them first, but with what?" His young assistant, now Major Sergeyev, spoke quietly.
"Every time we break through, sir, they slow us down and counterattack. This was not supposed to happen."
"A splendid observation. We expected a breakthrough would have the same effect as in the last war against the Germans. The problem is these new, light anti-tank missiles. It only takes 3 men in the American's jeep to race along the road, set up, fire 1 or 2 missiles, and be gone before we can react. Then they repeat the process only a few 100 meters away. Defensive firepower was not so strong before, and we failed to appreciate how effectively a handful of rearguard troops can slow down an advancing column. Our security is based on movement. A mobile force under these conditions cannot afford to be slowed down. We have learned that a simple breakthrough is not enough."
"You say we cannot win?"
"I say what I said 4 months ago. This campaign of ours has become a war of attrition. For the moment, technology has defeated the military art, ours and theirs. What we're doing now is seeing who runs out of men and arms first."
"We have more of both."
"That is true, Major. I have many more young men to throw away."
"Comrade General, I received a message from my father. He wishes to know how things progress at the front. What shall I tell him?"
"Tell the minister that NATO opposition is far more than what we expected. The key is now supplies. We need the best information we can get on what NATO's supply situation is, and a determined effort to worsen that situation. We have received little information on how well go the naval operations to kill NATO convoys. I need that in order to evaluate NATO's endurance. I don't want analysis out of Moscow. I want the raw data."
"You are unhappy with what we get from Moscow?"
"We were told that NATO would be politically divided, making them militarily uncoordinated. How would you evaluate that report, Comrade Major?" "I can't go through military channels with that sort of request, can I? Write up your travel orders. I want you back here in 36 hours. I'm sure we'll still be here."
After delivering the USS Ferris safely to a Boston port, Commander Morris had only 48 hours leave before getting a new command. He was flown into Norfolk to pick up the USS Reuben James and was given orders to move out on arrival. He was retracing the flight he had just made, this time by water. He was exhausted, but he had a fresh crew. Captain, sorry to disturb you, sir. We got a request to check something out. Probably a snowbird, but... Well, here, sir. This is the dispatch. Yeah, let me take a look. Unusual contact repeated several times. Have attempted localization without success. What the hell is this supposed to be? Beats me, Skipper. 40 degrees, 30 minutes north, 69, 50 west. They got a location, but no ID. Okay, let's see how it looks on the chart. Hell, that's nowhere near here. There's something familiar about the location. Let me get a closer look. Yes, sir, about a 60-mile run. Shallow water, too. Damn, I know what this place is. It's where the Andrea Doria sank. That's probably what they're getting on the radar. I don't think so, sir. A frigate heard something. They say they copied a strange sonar contact that faded out. They did a target motion analysis and generated this position. Their helo made a few passes and registered something right over the Doria site. Well, sounds like we're after a wild goose. But it's an official wild goose, so let's go get it. How soon can our helo get up? 10 minutes, sir. Okay, tell the bridge to take us there at 25 knots. We'll close it within 15 miles of the contact and have the helo search for it. The USS Reuben James was steered onto a precise northerly course. Morris instructed the helo captain to drop the sono buoys for a cross bearing. Sir, we've got something. Bearing 268. It's a Victor class, sir. A Victor with its reactor plant down to a minimum power output. Okay, let's get that helo to drop the charges one at a time. On my mark, stand by. Charge one, mark. Charge two, mark. Okay, get clear now. There was an odd flash of light from the bottom, then another. The surface of the sea turned to foam that leapt into the starry sky. The helicopter circled back in and switched on its landing lights. The surface was churned with mud, and it looked like oil. Just like in the movies, Morris thought. The helo dropped another sono buoy into the water. Damn! We got a hit, sir. Problem? I'm afraid the hit was the easy part. That reactor vessel's ruptured. You're hearing a runaway nuclear reactor, and we're 10 miles from shore. I'm afraid you've still got the hard work left. We gotta write the environmental impact statement. Bob Tolan had been to England many times, all on business with his opposite numbers at government communications headquarters. His flights always seemed to arrive at night. He was flying at night now, and something was wrong, something obvious. Blackout. There were few lights below. Just as he began to get nervous about the possible dangers, he thought of his friends Ed Morris and Danny McCafferty and wondered how they were doing. He did not yet know that, with a routine telex message sent a week before, he would directly affect their lives. Commander Tolan, last week you sent a message to our air operations chaps to the effect that your Tomcats were able to track Russian backfires visually at a very long range. Yes, sir, we have a new video camera system. It's designed to identify fighter-size aircraft at 30 miles or so. Tracking something as big as a backfire, they can do it 50 or so, if the weather's good. And the backfires would not know they were there? Not likely, sir, no. How far could they follow a backfire? Good question, sir. With fuel support, we can keep a Tomcat aloft for almost 4 hours, 2 hours each way.
And how sure are we of the Russians operating airfields?
For the backfires, sir, they operate from the four fields at Kirovsk Island. Do you have the new satellite photo, sir? They hadn't come in when I left.
Yes, here.
Looks like they lit smoke pots during the satellite pass, and it looks like the flares mess up the infrared imaging systems as well. Well, there are the hardened shelters and... What, three aircraft? Was this taken during a raid?
Correct. Very good.
And what are these? Fuel bowsers? They're refueling them right after they land?
We think, yes, before they get into the shelters. Evidently, they don't like the idea of fueling inside a building. It seems reasonable enough. They've had numerous problems with accidental explosions the last few years.
Yes, sir, they have, sir. This would be a hell of a nice time to catch them on the ground, but we don't have any tactical aircraft that'll reach that far. B-52s could do it, but they'd be murdered.
Yes, but a Tomcat could trail the backfires nearly to the Russian doorstep, and that could allow you to predict exactly when they'll land.
Plus or minus 15 minutes.
Yes, Admiral, I think we can do that. I wonder how long it takes to refuel a backfire. Commander, let me brief you on something called Operation Doolittle. I want your evaluation of how we can improve the basic operational concept.
Yes, sir.
So, what does your father report on the fuel availability?
The situation is grim, sir. At current operational tempos, 1 month. And to do this, we have crippled the whole national economy. My father asks if we can reduce expenditures at the front.
Certainly. And we can lose the war. That will save fuel.
Comrade, sir, you requested that I provide you with accurate information. I have done this. My father sends this KGB intelligence assessment intended only for the Politburo. It makes very interesting reading. He asks me to point out the risk he has taken in giving you this document.
Alexeyev read the report quickly. The preliminary discussion was an inquiry into the possibility of a negotiated settlement. The KGB's assessment was that this reflected the fragmentation of NATO politically and possibly reflected a grave supply situation on the other side of the battle line. The KGB calculated that NATO supplies were now down to the 2-week mark, despite all the shipping that had arrived to date.
My father feels that these data on the Germans are particularly significant.
Potentially so. They will not slacken their fighting while their political leadership works to achieve an acceptable settlement. But if we can make them an acceptable offer and remove the Germans from NATO, then our objective is achieved, and we can seize the Persian Gulf at leisure. What offer are we making to the Germans?
This has not yet been decided. They have asked for our withdrawal to pre-war lines, with final terms to be negotiated on a more formal basis under international supervision. Their withdrawal from NATO is to be contingent upon the terms of the final treaty.
Not acceptable. It gives us nothing. Why are they negotiating at all?
Evidently, there has been considerable turmoil in their government over the dislocation of civilians, destruction of economic assets, and so forth.
And did your father explain why they haven't told us this?
The Politburo feels that news of a possible negotiated settlement would discourage further pressure on the Germans.
Idiots! This sort of thing tells us what to attack! You must tell the minister that I see no indication at all of weakening NATO resolve on the battle line. German morale in particular is still high. They resist everywhere. Major, is it a possibility that this report has been falsified?
My father would like your opinion on that, sir.
The briefing was conducted by a captain. As he spoke, the submarine escort commanders and the carrier convoy commanders leafed through the briefing documents like high school seniors at a Shakespearean play. The briefing was conducted by a captain moving a pointer across a viewgraph. The frigates USS Reuben James and the Royal Navy's broadsword will be almost 30 miles from the rest of the formation. That'll put them outside SAM missile coverage from the other ships. They have their own surface-to-air missiles, but they'll be completely on their own for the most part. Our ships are repositioning themselves now. We can expect Soviet submarine and air attacks. We'll have carrier and sub support for the convoy, and the new Aegis cruiser will also be traveling with us. By the way, the Air Force will be taking out the Russian Rorsat on its next pass, about 1200 hours Zulu tomorrow. Gentlemen, we are delivering a total load of over 2 million tons of equipment, plus a complete armored division made up of reserve and guard formations. Not counting the material reinforcements, this is enough to keep NATO in action for 3 weeks. Any questions? No? Then good luck.
Beagle calling doghouse. Over. I have information for you. We see backfire-type bombers southbound over our position.
Roger, we copy. How do you know they're backfires?
Because I'm a damn good weatherman, sir. No shit, they're backfires. 4 of them. Correction, 5 aircraft southbound.
Roger, thank you, Beagle. Just what we needed to know. Hang in there. We haven't forgotten you. Out.
4 hours later, the last backfire bomber circled, waiting to land. The pilot checked his fuel. About 20 minutes left. There wasn't that much of a hurry. Suddenly, a small white object appeared over the runway in front of him. The first of 12 Tomahawk missiles cut across the runway at a shallow angle. The blunt nose cover sprang off the airframe, and several hundred small bomblets began to sprinkle over the area. There were 17 backfires already on the ground. 10 were being fueled from trucks in the open. The others were armed and ready for another mission. The Tomahawk dropped its complete load, then climbed straight up stalled, and crashed back to Earth, adding its own fuel load to the destruction. A ready force backfire went first. The circling pilot watched in horror as 10 bombers exploded before his eyes. It was over in 2 minutes. After discussing, then dismissing, the possibility of a settlement, the Politburo meeting adjourned. As Minister Sergeyev left, the chief of the KGB asked if he would like to take a ride and talk. Sergeyev's blood chilled, but he tried not to look alarmed.
So, comrade, what is it you wish to talk about? Tell me, do you know the significance of the American attack on our airfields?
A troublesome development, to be sure, but...
I see. I thought you did not. Several NATO convoys are at sea. A major one left New York several days ago. It carries a complete American division to Europe. In destroying a number of our bombers, NATO has significantly reduced our ability to deal with the convoys. They have also cleared the way for direct attacks against Soviet soil.
But Iceland?
Iceland will soon be neutralized.
So you tell me the war goes badly? Then why does Germany make overtures for peace? If you are suspicious of the Politburo, you should not come to me.
Let me tell you a little story, comrade. Back in January, when I had my heart surgery, day-to-day control of the KGB passed to the first deputy chairman, Joseph Larinov. Have you met little Joseph? Ambitious little Joseph was called in to give the KGB's official intelligence assessment of our state of readiness. I was not consulted, of course. He did not want to impede my recovery, and neither did our fellow members of the Politburo. Young Joseph, the ambitious little bastard who wants my job, was clever enough to bring my best case, worst case, and middle case assessments with him, and then present them with the right case, determined by what he thought they wanted to hear. The best case scenario, not that he called it that, he only presented it as my report. I should have killed the son of a bitch. But this was not possible. He has the ear of the General Secretary, as well as the Defense Minister. I am a sick old man. They have told me this. Joseph controls one faction of the KGB, I the other. But Joseph... I think Joseph's health is not so good either. Although he is not aware of it. Well, we have reached your destination. You go. Soon we will take another ride, yes? We will talk more then.
Sergeyev watched the KGB limousine pull away and disappear. He had played many power games in his life, but never had the game been this dangerous.
Doghouse! Doghouse, this is Beagle. We are under attack.
Beagle, we are now in contact with the Navy carrier. Stand by. Beagle, the Navy carrier is now on your frequency. Go ahead and transmit. Their call sign is Starbase, and they know where you are.
Starbase, this is Beagle. Over.
Roger, Beagle. We show you position 5 miles west of Hill 1064. Tell me what's happening. Beagle, please respond. Are you there? Over.
Starbase, this is Beagle. I've been hit, and they hit my officer. The woman is okay. Tell your birds to hurry. I don't know how long I can hold them.
Roger that. Hold it together, son. Help is coming.
The USS Chicago was about 5 miles ahead of her sisters, the Boston and the Providence. There was only a little further to go to the jagged edge of the Arctic ice. Every hour, McCafferty would maneuver his sub to an easterly course and allow his sonar array to get a precise fix on the Soviet ships. Their Tango-class subs were formidable opponents, quiet and hard to locate, but the Russians were still paying for their unsophisticated sonars. All in all, McCafferty was more confident now than he'd been in weeks. About the only bad news was the storm on the surface.
The sea conditions were grinding acre-sized ice floes into ice chips. That much noise would make the American subs very hard to detect once in the ice. Not long now, he thought, and then we're out of here. The convoy will get in.
Sir, we have a contact. Not enough data to classify at this time. It's too sketchy, sir, but I'd say it smells like a nuclear boat. Sound general quarters?
All stations report manned and ready. Sir, we've got a contact bearing 095. That's almost exactly between Boston and Providence. That must be an Alpha we're looking at, sir.
Damn, he's too close to Providence to fire. Sonar, go active. Yankee search on bearing 095.
Sir, I have hull popping noises and increased machinery noise on that bearing. No target on the scope yet. Transients, Boston just increased power, sir. There goes Providence. Torpedoes in the water, bearing 095. Multiple torpedoes in the water at 095.
All ahead full.
The Alpha was perilously close to both subs, behind both, and Providence couldn't run, couldn't dive, couldn't do a goddamn thing. The Alpha had fired four fish, two at each American boat. Boston changed course west, as did Providence.
McCafferty watched as the contact lines went left and right across the screen. The thick ones denoted the submarines, with thinner, brighter lines for each of the four torpedoes. The two aimed at Providence closed rapidly. It was clear in a minute that she'd never make it. The lines converged to a single point that blossomed bright on the screen.
Boston had a better chance. One torpedo went wild, diving after decoy and exploding on the bottom. But the other locked on Boston and slowly ate up the distance. Another bright dot appeared, and that was that. McCaffrey's voice was low, but his rage was evident.
Yankee searched the Alpha.
Bearing 109, range 13,000.
Set. Match and shoot.
The Alpha didn't wait to hear the incoming torpedoes. Her skipper knew that there was a third sub out there, knew that he'd been pinged. The Soviet sub went to maximum speed and turned east. Chicago's weapons officer tried to move the torpedoes on a closing course, but they had a scant 5-knot advantage on the Alpha, and the math was clear. They'd come up 2,000 yards short at the end of their fuel. But McCafferty was past caring. He, too, went to flank speed and chased after her for a half hour, 3 minutes before the torpedoes would run out of fuel. The flow noise cleared off his sonars just in time to hear the Alpha decelerate.
Okay, now let's go for her.
Sir, we got a new contact bearing 003.
Damn, careful on this one. Could be a trap.
Transients, torpedo in the water bearing 005. Left full rudder, all ahead flank. Sir, bearing change, torpedo bearing now 008. Belay that order. That new contact is shooting at the Alpha. Can you classify? It's a Brit. That's one of the new spearfish. I didn't know they had any in the fleet yet. How fast is she moving? 70 knots, sir.
Damn, let's buy some.
They got a hit, sir. The Alpha is hit.
All right. Bring her around north. Go to 18 knots. Let's make radio contact. I want to make sure they know who we are.
Please identify. This is the USS Chicago, Commander McCafferty.
This is Captain Little, HMS Torbay. You alone?
Yes, we're alone. The Alpha ambushed us.
We will escort you.
Understood. Do you know if the mission was successful?
Yes, it was. Convoy is pulling into port.
Sir, I've got a friend commanding the USS Reuben James. I was wondering if...
Don't see her on the down list. I'd say you could assume her safe arrival.
Toland eyed the prisoner carefully as he walked into the hospital ward. The information in his file said that Major Alexander Georgievich Chapayev was 30 years old, second son of the commander of the Moscow Air Defense District, married to the youngest daughter of a Central Committee member. He was therefore probably a young man with access to lots of under-the-counter information. Toland spoke in Russian.
Good evening, Major Chapayev. How's the leg? Are you being treated properly?
I have no complaints. Your Russian is fair.
I do not often get to practice with a Soviet citizen. Perhaps you can help me somewhat.
With your grammar?
At ease, Major. You were the commander of the MiGs, right? You know that they're all finished now.
Yes, I was the senior flying officer.
I've been told to compliment you. I am not a flyer myself, but they tell me your tactics over Keflavik were excellent. I believe you had 5 MiGs. We lost a total of 7 aircraft yesterday, 3 to MiGs, 2 to missiles, and 2 to ground fire. Considering the odds, we were disagreeably surprised.
I had my duty.
Da. We all have our duty.
If you are concerned at how we will treat you, you should not be. You will be treated properly in all respects. I don't know what you have been told to expect, but probably you have noticed once or twice that not everything the party says is completely true. I see from your identification papers that you have a wife and two children. I have a family, too. We'll both live to see them again, Major. Probably, anyway. Unless our bombers attack you. Well, I guess no one told you. That happened 3 hours ago. But things did not go well for your side. Your Air Force is no longer a threat to us. Submarines are another matter, but there is no sense asking a fighter pilot about that. In fact, this isn't really an interrogation. I'll be asking you some questions later. I just wanted to come down and say hello. Is there anything I can get you? Anything you need?
I do not believe you.
Comrade Major, there is no point in asking you about the MiG-29s, because none are left on Iceland. All the others in the Soviet Air Force are in Central Europe, and we're not going there. There is no point in asking you about ground defense positions on Iceland. You're a pilot, and you don't know anything about that. The same is true of the remaining threat against us, submarines. What do you know about submarines? Think, Major. You are an educated man. Do you think you have information that we need? I doubt it. You will be exchanged in due course for our prisoners. A political question for our political masters. Until then, we will treat you properly.
You will just send me home after...
We don't have labor camps, and we don't kill prisoners. If we were going to mistreat you, why did the surgeon sew up your leg and prescribe pain medications?
The pictures I had with me?
I almost forgot. Isn't it against the rules to take this up with you?
I carry it for luck. My wife and our twin daughters. I want to see them again.
Yeah, I know. I've been away a long time, too. Here, these are mine. That's my wife and my son.
Your wife is too skinny, but you are a lucky man also.
Yeah, you know, we have to be crazy to leave them.
We have our duty.
Duty? These damn politicians just tell us to go, and we go, like idiots. Hell, I don't even know why the goddamn war started.
You mean you do not know?
Bob Toland's tape recorder ran for another 20 minutes. He couldn't believe it. The Major thought NATO already knew. And why wouldn't he? The KGB is competent enough. Why would he assume American intelligence was not? They had had the information all along and ignored it. Oil. Major Sergeyev had just returned from another trip to Moscow and was making his report to Alexeyev. You were right to have me float your rationale for future operations with my father. He and the KGB director feel that for you to propose this openly would mean your instant arrest. The Politburo still feels that victory is possible. When they lose that belief, anything is possible. Anything. Your plan to put experienced troops into the arriving divisions until a settlement is reached has merit. Anyone can see that. But you must not let them know that this is a temporary measure.
What? You speak to me of treason.
We are talking about the survival of the motherland.
Do not confuse the importance of your own skin with the importance of our country. You are a soldier, as am I. Our lives are expendable pawns.
For our political leadership, your respect for the Politburo comes late, Comrade General.
I went to your father instead of to them because he is a reasonable man. I hoped he could persuade them to a moderate course of action, a compromise timed to meet the Politburo's own needs for negotiation.
The time for moderation is long past. My father spoke against the war, as did others. If you propose a diplomatic solution, you will be arrested and shot for failing to achieve your assigned objective, and for daring to propose political policy to the party hierarchy. My father fears that the Politburo will lean towards a nuclear resolution of the conflict. The party and the revolution have been betrayed, Comrade General. If we do not save them, both are lost. My father says that you must decide whom and what you serve.
And if I decide wrongly?
Then I will die, and my father, and others. And you will not have saved yourself.
Major, you try to manipulate me like a child. Your father told you that I would not cooperate unless you convinced me of the idealistic, the
the rightness of your action. My father told me to remind you that you are a man of the party, that it is time for the people to reclaim the party for themselves.
Ah, and this is why he conspires with the director of the KGB? Does he know this is a man who would murder our country's own children for his own political gain?
Do you blame the sword for the hand that wields it? If so, what does that make you?
It is not an easy thing to overturn the state.
Comrade General, is it your duty to carry out orders that will only bring about its destruction? We do not seek to overturn the state. We seek to restore the state.
Oh, we will probably fail.
But if I must die, better that it should be as a man than a dog. I have come to see you grow into a man. The motherland must ensure that her children all have the opportunity to do this. I will formulate a plan to ensure that we do not fail.
They had reached the ship safely. Edwards tried to sit up a little straighter in the bed. The tubes in his arm and the cast on his leg didn't help. The landing ship's hospital was full of wounded men. The general approached him.
So you're Beagle?
Yes, General. And this is Miss Vigdis.
Nice to meet you, Miss Vigdis. I have a daughter about your age. I heard this man here saved your life. You've done pretty well for a weatherman, Lieutenant. You told us what Ivan had on this rock and where they were, or at least where they weren't. You and your people did a lot more than just keep out of the way, son. I'm presenting this to you for a job well done, Marine.
Sir, I'm in the Air Force.
Oh, yeah? Well, this Navy Cross says you're a Marine. By the way, I thought you might want to know our ground forces have arrived. Take good care of this man, Miss Vigdis.
In Moscow, Minister Sergeyev was listening to the KGB's analysis of the latest plans being made by the Politburo.
First of all, Comrade Sergeyev, the Defense Minister wishes to initiate the use of a few small tactical nuclear warheads. Second, he hopes for your support. They have summoned Alexeyev to Moscow to seek his assessment of their plans and how best to implement them. He is on his way now.
I cannot believe that the defense minister can actually get the votes to implement plans that call for nuclear weapons. I cannot believe it. I will never give him my support.
But you must, and Alexeyev must agree. There is nothing to fear. No nuclear bombs will be used. I have already seen to that.
What do you mean? Surely you'll know who controls the nuclear weapons in this country. My people control the warheads, and Joseph's faction of the KGB does not include anyone in that segment. So, comrade, you must play along, and we must get word to Alexeyev.
The minister's driver was summoned and handed a note to depart at once for the airport. 40 minutes en route, he noticed that his gas gauge was down. Odd, he'd just filled the car up the day before. The Politburo members were never short of anything. But the gauge kept dropping. Then the engine stopped. He got out and opened the hood. He checked belts and electrical connections. Everything seemed as it should. He got back in and tried to start the car, and nothing happened. A moment later, he figured out that the alternator had gone bad. The battery was completely flat. Alexeyev's transport was just arriving. A staff car provided by the commander of the Moscow military district motored up to the plane, and General Alexeyev and his aide, Major Sergeyev, got in at once for the ride to the Kremlin.
Wait outside, please, Major.
Comrades, General Colonel P.L. Alexeyev reports as ordered.
The comrade secretary spoke first.
Welcome to Moscow, Comrade General. What is the situation in Germany?
Both sides are exhausted, but still fighting. The current tactical situation is one of stalemate. We have more troops and weapons available,
but we are critically short of fuel. But we can win. Given several days to organize my forces, I think that it is likely that we can still sunder the NATO front. What would you need to make victory certain?
I need the right weapons, and I need to know that you can prevent NATO retaliation.
The use of tactical nuclear weapons could increase our chances measurably, but I will need direct control of the weapons.
Why would you need direct control?
It is a matter of practicality, comrades. Targets will appear and disappear on a minute-to-minute basis. If you want me to blast a hole in NATO lines with atomic arms, I will not have the time to get your approval.
How many would you need?
We would use small weapons against discrete targets, not population centers. I would say a maximum of 30 weapons in the 5 to 10 kiloton range. We would launch them with free-flight artillery rockets.
How soon will you be ready for your attack?
That depends on how quickly I can get veteran troops into the new divisions. This is essential. If our reservists are to survive on the battlefield, we should get experienced men to work with them.
In 2 days, you will return with detailed plans for your breakthrough. General, you are the first real fighting soldier I've seen in years. Thank you for your report.
As Alexeyev exited the building, he turned to his assistant.
Major, since we're in Moscow, perhaps you would like to visit your father, the minister, before we return to the front. You have earned the rest, and I want figures on our oil supply.
Thank you, sir. Are you certain you will not require my services while we are here?
No, you will have a temporary replacement. I will see you again in 2 days.
Major Arkady Sorokin was short, like most paratroop officers. A handsome young man with light brown hair, his blue eyes burned for a reason that Alexeyev understood better than the major did. The young soldier limped slightly from 2 bullets he'd taken in the leg during the initial assault of the Keflavik airbase on Iceland. On his breast was the ribbon of the Order of the Red Banner, earned for leading his company into enemy fire. Sorokin and most of the early casualties had been flown out for medical treatment. He and they were now awaiting new assignments since their division had been captured on Iceland.
How may I serve the general?
I need a new aide, and I prefer officers with combat experience. More than that, Arkady Sorokin, I will need you to perform a delicate task. But before we discuss that, there is something I need to explain to you. Please sit down.
The doctors advised me not to run on it for another week. They were right. I tried to do my 10 kilometers yesterday and pulled up lame after only 2.
Alexeyev noticed that he didn't smile. He probably hadn't smiled since last May, since his daughter, who was supposed to perform for the Politburo, was murdered in that terrorist act. Alexeyev explained to him for the first time that this was not an act of terrorists, at least not German terrorists. Alexeyev noticed that the paratrooper's hand was opening and closing beside the arm of the leather chair, just about where his pistol holster would be if he'd been standing. Alexeyev concluded by obtaining the agreement he sought.
Major, the essence of a soldier is discipline. I have brought you here for a reason, but I must know that you will carry out your order exactly. I will understand if you cannot.
Yes, Comrade General, and I thank you from my soul for bringing me here. It will be exactly as you say.
Come then, we have work to do.
The morning of his appointment, at exactly 9:30, when the Politburo was calling its daily meeting to order, Alexeyev arrived at the Kremlin, escorted by his new recruits. Alexeyev jumped off an infantry carrier with the agility of a young corporal. He waved the line of vehicles past, saluting the officers who rode proudly in their vehicles. It was 5 minutes until the 2nd Regiment passed, and he waited for its 2nd Battalion to reach him. Captain Sorokin, his new assistant, was in the battalion command vehicle and leaned over to grasp the general's hand and pull him up off the street.
An old man like you could get hurt this way, Comrade General.
You young buck, are you ready?
I am ready.
Good. It is too late to stop. Remember your orders and keep control of your men.
Now.
In the back of the command vehicle, the communications officers activated the divisional radio net and announced an explosion in the Kremlin. A battalion of riflemen under General Alexeyev's personal command was going in to investigate. He shouted to the Kremlin guards,
"What the hell is going on here? You have allowed another attempt to kill the Politburo. My men will secure the area."
Those guards who hesitated to get out of the way were shot down. The others were arrested. Alexeyev walked to his meeting accompanied by his assistant. They found 21 old and middle-aged men standing at the windows watching a small infantry engagement that had about run its course. The guards stationed throughout the Kremlin grounds were not organized for this sort of assault and had not the smallest chance of overwhelming a company of experienced riflemen. The defense minister turned around first and saw that the two men were waving their pistols. Alexeyev took immediate control.
"Comrades, please go back to your seats. Evidently, there is a plot to seize the Kremlin. Fortunately, I was just arriving for my appointment when this column of troops passed by." "Sit down, comrades."
The defense minister was the only man to object.
"What the hell is going on here? Alexeyev, you are signing your own death warrant."
"When I entered military school 34 years ago, I swore an oath to defend the state and the party from all enemies, including those who would kill my country because they don't know what the hell else to do. Comrade Sergeyev, you and the director of the KGB will stay. The others will be leaving in a few minutes. Comrade Defense Minister, if you reach for the phone again, you will be making a serious mistake. We can very easily kill you all. That would be much more convenient than what we have in mind. Your escorts are ready to leave now. If one of you attempts to speak to anyone, you will all be killed immediately. Two by two, start moving."
The director of the KGB approached.
"Well done, Alexeyev. Things are ready at Lefortovo. The men on duty are all mine." "There has been a change in plans. They're not going to Lefortovo. They go to the old airport, and after that, I will helicopter them to a military camp commanded by someone I trust."
"But I have it all arranged."
"Yes, I'm sure you do. This is my new aide, Major Sorokin. Major Sergeyev is at the camp right now, making final arrangements. Tell me, Comrade Director, does Sorokin look familiar to you?" "He was a captain, since promoted for bravery, in the 76th Guards Airborne Division."
"Yes? Should I know him?"
"Major Sorokin had a daughter in the Young Octoberists. Surely you remember this man from his daughter's funeral?"
"For my daughter who died without her face!"
Sergeyev leaped out of the way and looked to Alexeyev for an explanation. Alexeyev gave him one.
"Even if you trust a murderer of children, I do not. And I would never take orders from one. I'll leave you with a company of loyal troops. I must get control of the army. Your job is to get control of the party apparatus."
Sergeyev was surprised at how easy it was. The number of people who actually knew what had happened was under 200. The fighting had all taken place within the Kremlin walls. He had several friends in the Central Committee, and these did what they were told in the emergency. By the end of the day, the reins of the party were shared among three men. The other Politburo members were under armed guard outside the city. The Politburo's pervasive control of all aspects of Soviet life prevented people now from asking the questions that had to be asked before any organized resistance could begin. Every hour gave Sergeyev and his clique more time to consolidate their rule. The three men formed a troika, which would appeal to their countrymen until more of their people could be brought in. One paramount task remained. The sound of helicopter rotors filtered through the trees. Alexeyev stood in a small clearing next to a command vehicle. The crew was in the trees, along with a platoon of riflemen. It was unlikely, but NATO could seize the opportunity to attack and kill. No, he thought. We're not that crazy, and neither are they. He warned his men to stay back. The American general approached. Salutes were exchanged, but neither wanted to offer a hand first.
"You are Alexeyev.
I expected someone else.
Yes, General Robinson. Marshal Bukharin is now in retirement. Your Russian, sir, is excellent.
Thank you, General Alexeyev. Some years ago, I got interested in the plays of Chekhov. You can really understand a play only in its original language. Since then, I've read a good deal of Russian literature.
The better to understand your enemy. Very sensible of you. General, I am interested in a termination of hostilities.
I am listening.
You know, of course, that I had no part in starting this madness.
What soldier ever does, General? We merely shed the blood and get the blame. Your father was a soldier, was he not?
Yes, a tanker. He was luckier than your father.
That's often what it is, isn't it?
Luck? We should not tell our political leaders that.
Then who are your political leaders? If we are to reach a workable agreement, I must be able to tell mine who is in charge.
The General Secretary of the Communist Party is Mikhail Eduardovich Sergeyev. As you Americans are so fond of saying, it was time for a change.
What is your proposal?
I do not know how to be a diplomat, only a soldier. We propose a ceasefire in place, followed by a phased withdrawal to pre-war positions over a period of 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks, I can achieve that without a ceasefire.
At great cost and greater risk.
We know that you're short of fuel. Your entire national economy could come apart.
Yes, and if our army comes apart, as you say, we have only one defense option to safeguard our state.
Your army has launched a war of aggression against the NATO alliance. Do you suppose that we can let you return to status quo ante? Nothing else? And don't tell me about the Kremlin bomb plot. You know sure as hell Germany had no part of that.
I have told you that I had no part in this. I follow orders. But did you expect the Politburo to sit still while our national economy ground to a halt? What political pressure would you have put on us then, if you knew about our oil shortage?
We didn't until just a few days ago. Why didn't you just tell us you needed oil?
And you would have given it to us? I do not have your degree in international relations, but I am not so much of a fool as that.
We would have demanded and gotten concessions of some kind, but don't you think we would have tried to prevent all this? Your Politburo launched a war of aggression. How many are dead because of them?
The men who made that decision are under arrest. They will be tried in a court of the people for crimes against the state. Comrade Sergeyev spoke against the war and has risked his life, as have I, to bring it to a just end.
We want them. We will reconvene the Nuremberg Tribunal and try them for crimes against humanity.
You may have them only after we are finished with them.
It will be a dull trial, General Robinson.
You think your countries have suffered? Someday I will tell you about the suffering we have endured from these corrupt men.
And your junta will change that?
How should I know? But we will try. In any case, that is not your concern.
You talk with great confidence for the representative of a new and very shaky government.
And you, Comrade General, talk very confidently for a man who less than 2 weeks ago was on the brink of defeat. I offer you a ceasefire in place. It could begin as early as midnight. After that, in 2 weeks, we return to our pre-war lines and the killing will stop. We can work out the exchange of prisoners later.
How do I know that you will not use the 2 weeks to prepare a new offensive?
How do I know that you will not launch the counterattack you have scheduled for tomorrow?
Actually, a few hours from now. Will your political leaders abide by your terms?
Yes. Will yours?
I must present it to them. But I do have the authority to honor a ceasefire.
Then the decision is yours, General Robinson.
The general's aides were standing uneasily together at the edge of the trees. Also watching were a platoon of Soviet infantrymen and the crew of the helicopter. General Robinson extended his hand.
Commander Dan McCafferty was part of a battle group heading southwest to hit the Russian bases around Murmansk when the recall order came.
Lieutenant Bob Toland had been going over estimates of Russian fighters and SAM strengths. Commander Ed Morris was sitting on the pier at Norfolk, Virginia, being interviewed by a Reuters correspondent. A messenger ran down to him with a form. Morris opened the message, then looked up to see his crew waiting for a response.
It's official! It's over!
Hope you've enjoyed this production of Red Storm Rising by Tom Clancy, read by F. Murray Abraham. This program was directed by Charles Potter, produced by David Rapkin, and adapted by Brenda Hampton Kane. Text copyright 1986 by Jack Ryan Enterprises Limited and Larry Bond. Production copyright 1987, Random House Inc., all rights reserved.